The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay, what I wanted to talk about today is the end of European Jewry, primarily focusing, but not exclusively, on the Holocaust. And although the Holocaust is a huge subject, which I'm not going to go into all the history nor all of the lessons to be learned, I do want to sort of focus on the major lessons that we, from the traditional perspective, pull out of anti-Semitism in general and the Holocaust specifically. More specifically, I'm basically going to run through some of the information that we do in a seminar called Why the Jews, which, if you guys have seen it, it's a more in-depth look at the real meaning behind the Holocaust, which is the real thing, I think, to pull out of it, as in all aspects of Jewish history. What's the message? And if you want to get more information on it, I highly recommend seeing the seminar, going to the website if you have access to it, and it's on the online seminars part. You can check it out. Or reading Dennis Prager's book, Why the Jews, which is an excellent short book on anti-Semitism in general, which I think really drives home the point. And the Holocaust is merely a very intense version of what is, unfortunately, a very continuous phenomenon in Jewish history. Okay. Now, World War II does not happen in a vacuum. Many people correctly look at World War I and World War II as a continuum. So we have to back up and go to around the year 1900. And all the remaining time we're going to spend now is going to be more or less dealing with the very end of the 19th and the 20th centuries. We get to Zionism, we'll backtrack a little bit more in tomorrow's class.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just a second. So who wrote No Class on this? You did that?
I did that.
Okay, guys, in 1900, there were about 10.5 million Jews living in the world, of whom about 75% were living in Eastern Europe. Okay, now we talked a lot about what was going on in Western Europe and Eastern Europe already. We talked about the Dreyfus Trial. We see that even when we get to the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, anti-Semitism is alive and well, certainly in Western Europe, albeit in a less violent form. But we also talked about how in Eastern Europe, Kishinev pogroms and what was going on in the mass exodus of Jews was a direct response to what was a far more hostile situation. And out of that, we're going to see, is going to come a number of things. The situation in Eastern Europe, especially where the majority of the Jews are living, is going to be very precarious. And given what's going to happen in the world in the early 20th century, the whole, the center of the Jewish world is going to be shaken up in a way that is going to be quite disastrous. Certainly, the main event is World War I. Okay, now World War I, we talked a little about Russia. We know that there was an aborted attempt at a revolution in 1905. World War I is a... Forgetting what happens in Russia, in general, in Europe, is a disastrous. It's the first, so to speak, world war where we have major powers. If you know your history of the war, we have the central powers of Austro-Hungary and Germany, primarily allied against a coalition on the east and west of Russia in the east, and it's going to be France. Most of the fighting is going to take place in the war on the Western Front in France and in Belgium and in France. And England, eventually America, will join the war. But the war has a huge impact on all of Europe and specifically the Jewish community. And especially in Eastern Europe, all wars are very disruptive to civilian populations. In World War I, I'm sure you've read books and seen, when you have armies, large armies marching through cities and huge battles taking place in the middle of civilian areas, all you have left in the end. And certainly World War I was an incredibly destructive war. 8.5 million people died. It's the first war in human history. The Civil War, arguably, was the war where people had fairly modern weapons and were still using. You ever seen Civil War battles, like people standing, 100 feet from each other, shooting at each other with guns that were actually quite accurate? It wasn't like, in the Revolutionary War when anyone 15 feet away from you is, and you're lucky to be hitting anyone. So in the Civil War, you get massive, massive casualties. And by World War I, the ability to kill people had been really perfected to the point with machine guns and heavy artillery. And so it was quite, quite devastating. 1.5 million Jews are going to fight in World War I. Okay, we have Jews in almost in every army fighting against each other, Jews against Jews. You have Jews fighting in the Austrian army and Germans, and Jews fighting with in the Russian army and the French. 140,000 Jews are going to die in World War I. So it's Jews. This is, and again, probably from perspective of a great triumph that Jews could sit and fight and die for their countries. And in the minds of many Jews, I'm sure they were very happy to do such a thing. World War I begins in August of 1914. Actually, begins on August 1st, I believe, which happens to be Tisha B'Av, Okay, and just as we see, it's not an accident, obviously. If we look at World War I and World War II as a continuum, it makes sense that the event that triggers everything, there's no question that Hitler would never have come to power if not for World War I. It's a devastating economic plight that Germany finds itself in, which leads the Nazis to rise to power, you know, many decades later, is direct outgrowth of the crippling, you know, punitive debt that was leveled on Germany after the war was over in the Versailles Treaty. So we have to look at it as one giant continuum. And therefore, if we look at this as certainly the worst, if the Holocaust is the worst, you know, event certainly in Jewish history in the modern world, and it is a major event within World War II, and World War II is merely a continuum of World War I, and the fact that World War I begins on the 9th of Av, obviously is a very powerful statement there. And the final death blow, to more or less, to European Jewry is going to come out on that date, which has been so bad in Jewish history.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that again? That what was on the 9th of Av?
World War, August 1st, I believe, which is the start of 1914, which is the beginning of World War I, is Tisha B'Av of that year. So it makes sense that if World War I and World War II are a continuum, and the worst event of modern Jewish history is the Holocaust, which comes out of World War II, then it's only fitting, so to speak, that the beginning of all of this disaster should be that day, which is so incredibly bad in Jewish history. Before we look at the, I don't want to go into all details of World War I at all, it's not the topic of the class, but the place that has the biggest impact on the Jewish world is on the Russian front. Russia, by the way, initially has some successes, and the Russians, as we mentioned previously, is very backward in many ways. The peasants, I'm not talking about a well-educated population, although the early stages of the war, the Russians do well. Later on, they end up doing very, very badly. They sustain massive losses. You've seen pictures of World War I of like thousands and thousands, and they had a lot of people to fight in the army, surrendering to primarily the Germans. Okay, they lost very badly to the Germans. And it's during this period of time, we mentioned that Russia's already in a very bad state politically. We talked about all these Jews and all these different revolutionary movements. Eastern Europe was a hotbed of revolutionary movements, and Jews were disproportionately represented in all those movements. Why? As I said before, in an attempt to try and make the situation in Russia better than it was for the Jews, Jews gravitated naturally, being the big idealists that we are, into any kind of movement, albeit totally misdirected, such as communism, sort of a workers' utopian vision for the world. That's something that's going to attract Jews. So you have Jews very involved in revolutionaries at the time. There's all kinds of revolutionary foment going on in Russia. And when the war starts and Russia starts to lose very badly, we know that the Tsar is deposed, Nicholas II. You can go read the book Nicholas and Alexander, go read your Russian history books to find out more about that. And he is replaced, the situation in Russia is so bad, they're replaced by a sort of constitutional democratic government led by a guy named Kerensky, who led a group called the Mensheviks. I don't want to get into all the details. And the Mensheviks had the backing of the other Western powers who were fighting against Germany, Austria, Hungary, because their policy was to stay in the war. Okay, meaning that as long as Russia stays in the war, Germany, Austria-Hungary, Turkey, all those countries that were all allied together, have to fight a two-front war. Otherwise, they only could direct all their efforts towards the French and the British. The war is obviously devastating Russia, and out of this is going to appear the Communist Revolution. The Bolsheviks are going to seize power. Again, I'm running through a lot of history very, very quickly. Their major policy platform that was so different was they advocated that Russia should pull out of the war. And this begins the Russian Civil War, which is going to last from 1917 to 1921. As they seize power, the Mensheviks are thrown out of power. They're going to execute the Tsar and the family. The whole, you know, of course, the Jews, by the way, are blamed for that recently, of course. And led by Lenin, the Bolsheviks, the communists, are going to seize control of Russia, and they will stay in power from that period of time onward until Soviet Union falls apart in 1990, so to speak. But the Russian Revolution, obviously, Russia does pull out of the war, but there's tremendous fighting in Russia. The fighting is always bad. Obviously, civilians are killed, food distribution is disrupted, there's tremendous, you know, communities destroyed. There's a lot of pogroms against Jews during the Russian Revolution. It's estimated that 100,000 Jews were murdered during the revolution alone. You know, one thing's for sure, the Mensheviks might be fighting the Bolsheviks, but whoever, the Jews are going to get blamed for it no matter what. The white Russians especially were virulently anti-Semitic. White Russians meaning the backers of the Tsar. Okay, they were fighting for power. Who's fighting for who? Like who had the backing of the nobility? Who had the backing of the Allied powers? There's actually a secret war going on in Russia during this time called Kolchak's War, which is when all the Allied powers had soldiers. American soldiers were in Russia during the Civil War. Canadians, Japanese. That's the Japanese got a hold of their copies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Those same Japanese soldiers who fought in 1917, 1921, against the Bolsheviks went back and made the military government of Japan in the 1930s that seizes control. And they actually believed the protocols, which is why they hatched a plan to invite all the Jews of Eastern Europe during the Holocaust into China, which is their occupied territory, so that they'd make a superpower colony run by Jews, and the Jewish government in America, where Franklin Delano Rosenfeld ran the country, would lift the economic boycott against Japan. I kid you not. There's a whole book on it called The Fugu Plan. It's a very interesting side note to history. One of the few people in history who actually read the protocols and believed it, how they behaved towards the Jews versus how everyone else behaved. But anyway, it's the Jewish community, the center, the heart of the Jewish community of Eastern Europe is devastated by World War I. Okay, of tremendous poverty, increased anti-Semitism, lots of Jews fleeing, lots of murder and destruction and rape and pillage. Okay, and the whole community is shaken up. The myth of this sort of, as I said before, this kind of poor but stable Jewish world is really not accurate, especially at this period of time. The Jewish world was crumbling to pieces. And if things had gone differently, if the Holocaust hadn't happened, who knows what would have been. But there's no question that things would not have remained as they were. Okay, so I want to read you, by the way, this is the Bolsheviks, initially Lenin, who seizes control as the first leader of the Communist Party when it becomes a communist country. Lenin was actually very anti-Semitism. He made a fairly strong stand against it because it was such an intrinsic policy of the Tsarist government. Unfortunately, it's not going to be followed by his successor, Joseph Stalin, who's a virulent anti-Semite. But I want to read... But one of the attitudes which is prevalent is the idea that Jews are... course, bourgeoisie and into money and capitalism, and also present a certain danger. This is from the Yevsektsiya. It was in Russian. I could read a lot easier, I think. Jewish section of propaganda department of the Russian Communist Party. They actually had a whole section of the Communist Party propaganda dealing how to deal with Jews, and it's the liquidation of bourgeoisie Jewish institutions, October 1918. This is from the Jew in the Modern World. The Jewish community has hitherto been dominated by members of the property class who want to keep the masses in the dark by superimposing a Hebrew culture upon them. While the upper classes have been sending their children to public schools, they have provided only dark primary schools. They, in parentheses, heidarim is the word, you know, like we use for yeshiva. And synagogues, shuls for the offspring of the proletariat, in which nothing but nonsense is taught. You can see, this is a... In the struggle against the authorized Jewish community, kehile, they say, no compromise can be made with the bourgeoisie. All its institutions are harmful to the interests of the Jewish masses. In other words, the idea, and this is to a large extent led by communist Jews, because communism, besides Lenin, is overwhelmingly dominated by Jews. Zinoviev, Kamenev, Trotsky, the organizer of the Red Army, later murdered by Stalin in Mexico City. I mean, without Jews, there would be no communist revolution, I think, in Russia, clearly. But clearly what they're attacking, since Marx, you know, the religion is the opiate of the masses, they're clearly attacking the traditional Jewish infrastructure, as the way you read in the documents here. So communism is going to embark on a policy of deliberate forced secularization of Jews, closing down all religious institutions. To be fair, they did it to the Eastern Orthodox Church too, although that's the majority of the population. And Jews are going to be deliberately starved of their heritage. And as I mentioned in previous class, we're going to end up with a humongously large population of incredibly ignorant Jews that make even the most assimilated Jews in America seem knowledgeable because of deliberate policy, which is, by the way, quite unusual in human history. Deliberate secularization of a community in such to such a large extent for such a long period of time. Yeah.
Was there a very specific order for this plan, or was it just... At the same time, were Jews first, Catholics second?
There was a broad attack against all religious institutions. Most churches in Russia were gutted and turned into storehouses and movie theaters. I've been to the synagogue in Berdichev, I think, when I was there. And it's a movie house. You can see it's still a movie house. They got it back, the community, but it's still got the rows of seats in it, you know? I guess it makes good for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur Minyan. They have a lot of seating and a nice big stage. And you could do cultural activities because the movie theater is right there. But... it was a deliberate policy focusing on everyone. They were equal opportunity impressors of all religious institutions. The difference being that Jews are a far smaller minority. The Eastern Orthodox Church is very deeply rooted in Russian mentality. So they were not as successful. But they were pretty good. It was dangerous. When I was a student in Russia, it was dangerous to be seen outside a synagogue as a Jew, and it was dangerous to be seen outside a church. They had KGB hanging out in both places. You could lose your job for being openly religious. Now, I want to just jump a little bit ahead because we know that Stalin is going to seize power. And in 1935, Stalin initiates the purges, which is going to devastate Russia. Stalin is actually, in great mass murderers of the 20th century, Hitler is actually, according to most authorities, third on the list, having killed between people he executes a mere 12 million or so, whereas someone like Stalin is estimated during the purges, where all political opponents, albeit most of them were just pure paranoia, were sent to camps. You had these, you know, prisons. Lubyanka prison in Moscow is famous, KGB headquarters. The joke about Lubyanka was, why is Lubyanka the tallest building in Moscow? It's not. The Russians used to say, because even from the basement, you can see all the way to Siberia, which is where they would send you. It's estimated that something like 25 million people disappeared during the Stalinist purges. We're talking about from 1935 to when he dies, before he dies in 1953. And Jews overwhelmingly took the burden of the blame for what was going on in Russia. First of all, the competent communist leaders, many of whom are Jewish, are eliminated. He kills them all out. And he has Trotsky murdered in 1940 in Mexico City. A guy puts an ice pick through his head in his house. He was in exile. And even after the war, Stalin embarked, even after the Holocaust, when the Jews of Eastern Europe had been decimated, Stalin embarked on a plan. In 1953, nine prominent doctors, six of them Jewish, were accused of a plan to poison Stalin and take over, you know, one of these ridiculous things. Stalin hatched a whole plan called the Doctor's Plot. I actually know, I met the man whose father was the first guy accused, a Jewish guy in Moscow. The plan was to deport all the remaining Jews of the Soviet Union to Siberia and have them basically be murdered there. It's amazing. Right after the Holocaust, he planned to take care of another 2.5-3 million Jews. Thank God Stalin dies in mysteriously 1953. Probably, in my personal opinion, he was killed by the Politburo, realizing that he can't do this. You know, right after the Holocaust, it's just not acceptable to go murder a few more people. We don't know. But this is the unfortunate situation of the Jews in Russia before World War I, after, and leading all the way up till modern times.
Number
I didn't go through my list of great mass murderers. Mao Zedong is number one on the list. Okay, the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s, they estimate that 60 million Chinese died in the Cultural Revolution. But then again, you have a country of over a billion people. What's 60 million, you know? I didn't mean it. That, I obviously don't mean that seriously, but for him, that's not, we think of it as an unbelievable number of people, but then, sorry?
What's the time period that he...
The Cultural Revolution, the exact date, it's in the 60s. Mao's always killing opponents, but...
Roughly how many years would you say?
In a period of less than a decade. It's an incredible number of people. An incredible number of people. You gotta understand, if you read communist literature, like The Quiet Flows of the Don, you know, the notion of the cause and the individual being disposable, communism is certainly proven to be the great destroyer of human life in modern world. You know, it's amazing that the people like to say, like, look at what the world, you know, back in ancient... It's a very interesting lesson of modern history. We see certainly that in... although we have pretty brutal people in the ancient world, the biggest killers in modern history are people who are more or less are pagans. You think about it, the three biggest slaughterers of human beings in the 20th century, whether it be Stalin or Mao, who are communist atheists and believe in a vision of the world which looks at people as totally disposable, or Adolf Hitler, who said, I'm a barbarian. He was not a Christian, Hitler. He was Christian by birth, but not Christian as he viewed himself. It's the great lesson is, you know, although people have certainly killed many people in the name of God, the greatest loss of human life and destruction, mass murder, has been carried out in the name of movements that have nothing to do with God. Which I don't want to get into it now, so don't. But seriously, it's an interesting thing to think about. Yeah.
How many people did Stalin kill? 25 million years ago?
It's estimated. No one's going to know for sure. They're just releasing all the things now. Now that the Iron Curtain has come down, a lot of stuff is coming out. Now, by the way, you shouldn't think that Eastern Europe, because, and again, one of the great features of Jewish people is even in very adverse situations, economically, politically, anti-Semitism, there's still a lot of productivity in the Torah world. And again, it's one of the great really weird ironies of Jewish history. We are productive in situations that other people completely fall apart in. So although the community was definitely under siege internally and externally, there's a lot of good things coming out. Just to go through a few personalities again, one person who is a fantastic personality of this period is Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who's the Av Beis Din of Lithuania. He was the chief halachic authority of Lithuania, which is the center of the Jewish world. This is where all the big yeshivot are. And he's later the leader of the Agudas Yisrael. And Aguda is going to be set up in 1912. Which it was a blanket organization to take care of Jewish communal needs in Europe. Today there's an Agudas Yisrael, there's a political party Aguda in America, there's Agudas Yisrael in the United States. They were supposed to actually meet in the fall of 1914, but World War I broke out and they never got it together then. But later it's gonna be an institution that, at least in America and in Israel, is going to be a significant institution in the Orthodox world. Another very important person is Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, known to us as the Chafetz Chaim, who, by the way, is not a rabbi per se. He never had the title of smicha, but he was recognized by everyone to be one of the great halachic authorities. If you read the Mishnah Berurah, that is his commentary, which I'm sure you guys all study or will be studying soon. His dates are 1838 to 1933. He was also the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva in Radin, in Lithuania, and he's author of Shmiras HaLashon, which is this monumental book on the laws of Lashon Hara, which everyone studies today, which is a huge topic in the religious world. A few other personalities, Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh Leib Alter, who's the Sfas Emes of Ger, who died in 1905. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, who died in 1918. We mentioned that is that family, you know, Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University in New York. Rabbi Yehuda Epstein, the Orach HaShulchan, who died in 1908. That's a book I also mentioned previously, very important halachic work that we studied today. There are Soloveitchiks, but not this Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's the dynasties. There's many Soloveitchiks. And Rabbi Meir Shapiro, who was established Daf Yomi in 1923, which is a very interesting institution we have today. You learn a page of the Talmud a day. It's great. You go to the Siyum in Madison Square Garden, and you can see like 15,000 Jews all had just finished learning all of Talmud together. It's an amazing thing to watch, but a very important institution. Okay, what I want to do for the remaining part, yeah.
Okay, so quickly, would you say that this isolation, flourishing in the sense of isolation and insulation, would be a wonderful argument for the perpetuation of that today?
Isolation or insulation?
Well, both. Because what you say, the Jewish world, in fact, they had so much scholarship going on, was because they were isolated and they were insulated.
No, I don't think. No, I wouldn't say it's because of it. It comes during the period. I don't know that it's because of it all. We see that some of the greatest periods of Jewish scholarship when Jews aren't so isolated. I don't have a simple solution to how Jews should live. It's the hardest problem. One of the hardest problems we have to face. We can't live totally isolated, nor can we live totally amongst the Gentiles. We have to find some sort of medium, and it's a very, very hard thing to do. Without proper leadership and proper education system, it's very hard. If we had better leadership, it would be easier to do. I think it's more consequence of not having proper role models. Sort of like wandering Jews, wandering through history, and not really sure, as Abraham Joshua Heschel said, you know, the Jews are messengers who have gotten the message. You know, when
maybe
Jews...
Maybe too many role models?
Well...
You're not having one rabbi's decision, you go to another rabbi?
Well, there's a lot of rabbis running around, but role models we have very few of. Okay, and that's a big problem. I think strong leadership is the biggest problem. Unified Jews following one guy is definitely what we need. Now, granted, that's probably the hardest thing to do, but okay. No one said being a Jew is easy. It's definitely pleasurable and meaningful, but it's... Okay, what I want to do for the remaining period of time is talk about World War II. Again, not so much from history, which we're not going to get into at all, although I know you imagine I would love to talk about all the battles and everything, because it is certainly... very interesting conflict in human history, and a very bloody conflict in human history, where it's going to take out many, many more people than in World War One. World War Two, we're going to have over 50 million people dying. We're talking all told, the people Hitler kills, and including 22 to 25 million Russians die in World War Two. Unbelievable how many casualties. Between Stalin and Hitler, they took out like, you know, a third of the population of the country gets killed at the time, more than a quarter at least. Okay, Adolf Hitler, just to do a little bit of the background, but I want to focus on the message of the Holocaust from the traditional Jewish perspective. Hitler, who, by the way, interesting to keep in mind, Hitler had only positive interactions with Jews. You want to see a guy who's definitely an Amalekite. All the guys who bought his lousy artwork when he was a starving artist were Jews. His cook was Jewish. The family doctor was one of the few German Jews allowed to leave with, I think, 12 marks instead of 8 marks out of the country. Germans, when they threw the Jews out, didn't let them take money. Hitler even sent him a thank you note. You know, as a matter of fact, the person, Adolf Hitler, who was not a particularly impressive soldier in World War I, had an Iron Cross. He made a big deal of it. The Iron Cross is like the, what's the highest award? Congressional Medal of Honor in America. The person who nominated Hitler for an Iron Cross in World War I was a Jewish officer. He wouldn't have got it without the Jews. So no one should think that Hitler had some bad experience with Jews. Everything we know about indicates that he had only positive experiences, which only goes more to show that if any human being in modern history can be identified as an Amalekite, it's this guy Adolf Hitler. I mean, you're talking about deep-seated pathological hatred of Jews, not illogical. He has a very rational hatred of Jews. We'll see rational, I'll just explain in a minute. But it's a very important thing to know when we look at the whole thing of the meaning behind the Holocaust. It doesn't come from he was raised in like some neo-Nazi boot camp from age 2. Hitler, who is, by the way, imprisoned early on as a revolutionary in the Germany, that's where he writes Mein Kampf from prison. He's released from prison. He forms a minor party. Hitler was a brilliant manipulator, political manipulator. You know, you can say a lot of horrible things about them, he being evil incarnate, but you want to watch one of the greatest public speakers in human history that we have on tape. You watch a guy like a Hitler. He knows how to manipulate people. He's a real man of the media. You watch his speeches. Incredible. But Hitler, using democracy... manages to have himself elected into power. But Hitler's born in, I think it's 1889? Yeah, 1889. In 1932, he has himself elected as chancellor, and... No, excuse me. No, 1933, he's in the government in 1932, and 1933 he becomes chancellor. I don't want to go into the details of how he does it. He's not a majority in the government, but he manages to, as soon as he makes himself chancellor, eliminate all political opposition. It's immediately after that, Dachau, which is the first of the concentration camps, not the death camps, but is set up immediately after that, I think in 33 even, it's as early as 33, to start putting political opponents in. So Hitler, once he gets into power, basically takes what is a very sophisticated democratic system of the Weimar German Republic and turns it into a totalitarian state. And then he embarks on a policy of basically bullying his way into taking over much of Europe. Okay, we know that he gets the Anschluss in 1938. He absorbs Austria. He gets Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia, and all the European powers basically do nothing. There's a famous quote, I think it's Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister of England, goes in 1938, I believe, to Germany to negotiate a non-aggression pact, and he comes back with one of the great quotes of looking like a jerk after it's over, like gets up the airplane with holding up document, this guarantees peace in our lifetime, you know. This is, of course, 1 year before the greatest war in human history breaks out, which is going to destroy the British Empire. But Hitler, before he embarks on an open, aggressive conquest of Europe, he embarks immediately on a policy to get the Jews. Starting in 1935, he issues what's called the Nuremberg Laws. And the Nuremberg Laws basically took the Jews, who had for so long been not even citizens in Germany, and throws them back into a situation similar to what they find in medieval Europe, of no rights, you know, basically not even protected status, but persecuted minority, allowed to basically exist within the Germany. I just want to read you. This is some of the Nuremberg Laws. Laws for the protection of German blood and honor. It's a big thing to make sure, and it's what's the most ironic thing about the Holocaust is... You know, Jews were hated for so long for being different and not wanting to assimilate. Precisely when you get the most assimilationist German community in the world, the whole reason for anti-Semitism changes to make it impossible for the Jews to assimilate. Whereas 1,000 years before, Christians would have been happy to have Jews become Christians. Hitler's ultimate nightmare was that Jews should want to become Germans because they're going to poison. It's checkmate for the Jews, by the way. You hated us when we were different. Now you want to be the same, and now you're going to use all of your German technology and administrative skills to find anyone who's Jewish and... Yes. So if you read, the first thing he goes after is the idea of Jews interacting with Gentiles. So these are some of the laws for protection of German blood and honor. Imbued with the conviction that the purity of German blood is a prerequisite for future existence of the German people, the Reichstag was unanimously adopted the following law. Article 1. Marriages between Jews and subjects of German or kindred blood are forbidden. It's wild. We want to intermarry? We are at law saying you Jews can't intermarry. The Gentiles don't want us to intermarry with them. Article 2. Extramarital relationships between Jews and subjects of German or kindred blood are forbidden. 3. Jews must not engage in domestic service female subjects of kindred blood who are under the age of 45. No maid servants, right? You know, none of these maids too young unless you have any relations with them, God forbid. Article 4. Jews are forbidden to display the Reich and the national flag. Or to show the national colors. Jews can't show flags. You're not Germans. Don't you dare show our flag. This is Reich citizenship law. Article 2. A Reich citizen is only the state member who is a German, of German blood, and who shows through his conduct and is both desirous and fit to serve in the faith of the German people in Reich. The Reich citizen is the only holder of political rights. Article 4. A Jew cannot be a citizen of the Reich. He cannot exist. He cannot exercise the right to vote. He cannot occupy public office. So Jews lose their citizenship, become second-class citizens. You see, they're like in blacks in the South, you know, you have park benches for Jews and park benches for other people. And you have Jews, and this begins a process of systematically robbing the Jews of their political rights, any economic power the Jews have is going to be taken away. Of course, the first explosion of major Nazi violence against the Jews is Kristallnacht on November 9th, 1938. Okay, when you have 191 synagogues are destroyed, dozens of Jews are killed, beaten to death, and I think something like 30,000 Jews are arrested, and the Jews are fined for the damage that was caused by the Germans, a billion marks. Like $400 million fine is collectively leveled on the Jewish community. Okay, now, this is really the writing on the wall for the Jews. Those of people who were smart tried to get out. Unfortunately, we have to realize that during this period of time, that very few places in the world would accept any Jews. Switzerland took barely any Jews. When the foreign minister of Canada was asked how many Jews they should take, his response was, none is too many. America, which took a grand total of 200,000 Jews in World War II, had such strict, it's amazing, we talked about how, you know, the immigration laws in America, 2.5 million Jews came to America between 1880 and 1914. By the 1920s, early 20s, America starts instituting very severe immigration quotas out of fear. This is when the real xenophobic American ugly side of America appears, that it's going to be swamped by people, especially Jews, a lot of anti-Semitism in America. And the immigration quotas become much, much stiffer, and the doors of immigration are to a large extent closed on Jews. Even during the 1930s, when it was clear the Germans were persecuting the Jews, the American State Department had such strict criteria for allowing Jews into the country. You had to produce a sponsor, who had to produce a certain amount of money so that you wouldn't be a public burden, that three-quarters of the spaces that were allotted to Jews, technically by American law, were never even taken. It's amazing. So a lot of people, a lot of Jews who, in theory, could go to America, couldn't meet the requirements. Yeah.
You said 181 synagogues were destroyed?
191.
How many were there in the entire country?
You know? Virtually every synagogue in the country was destroyed. Virtually the exact number, but it wasn't too many more than that. between 1933 and 1945, about 800 to 900,000 Jews actually find refuge, but the majority can't. They have to remember that. There's a great book, what's his name? David Wyman, I think it's called, While 6 Million Died. There's a lot of books that have come out, you know, a stinging indictment of the world's lack of action towards the Jews. There's no question if after Kristallnacht, the Jewish community got up in arms in America and Germans backed off a little. If the world has gotten up and really stood up to the Germans, if during the height of the Holocaust, the Allies had advertised in Europe that when we get you Germans, we're going to execute every single one of you for what you did to the Jews, there's no question in my mind the Holocaust would have stopped. The Germans were clearly afraid of the consequences, which is why towards the end of the war they try and hide it. Very interesting. But anyway, I don't want to get into all the details, but ultimately what happens in the fall of 1939, Germany invades Poland. When it's already exhausted its ability to grab territory through just being aggressive without fighting, it invades Poland. That brings in, there's all kinds of military pacts between England and Poland, whatever. England's brought into the war. France is brought into the war. Germany, remarkably, very, very quickly, is able to conquer all of Europe. By May of 1940, virtually all of Europe is in the control. Sorry? All of Europe. In 6 weeks, everything in Europe falls. It's incredible how quickly the Germans take Western Europe. France, which is the big Maginot Line, it's kind of impregnable. The Germans just parachuted right over it. If you want to study military history, the Germans are the people who perfected the art of concentration of armor with air support and infantry blitzkrieg. They called it lightning war. And the Germans did not have very big tanks in the beginning of World War II, but they were brilliant. People like Edwin Rommel, the Desert Fox, who led the Afrika Korps. To give them credit where credit is due, modern warfare is to a large extent based on German military strategy. But the Germans are unstoppable. They signed, by the way, a pact with Russia in which 1939, there's a non-aggression pact between, it's called the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, in which they agree not to have aggression between Russia and Germany, and they divide up Poland, which again loses its national identity, between the two countries. And a lot of those Jews end up, most of the Jews have fled to the Russian side, by the way. In June 1941, Operation Barbarossa, the Germans, of course, violate the pact. The writing was on the wall clearly, but Stalin had purged his whole army of all of his competent generals. He'd killed them all. So Germany invades Russia and is incredibly successful, basically as fast as the Germans could walk, is as fast as they advance into Russia. And they find themselves with millions and millions and millions of Jews under their control. And they immediately begin these Einsatzgruppen, and these special German units. Before they industrialize the Holocaust, they immediately begin just executing people. And you have something like 1.5 million Jews are killed in the early stages just by machine gunning people. The place like Babi Yar. If anyone's been in September 29th, September 30th, 1941, the Germans execute something like 35,000 Jews in Babi Yar, which is this ravine. There's machine gun, thousands and thousands of Jews.
Where is Babi Yar?
Babi Yar is in Ukraine. I've been there several times. It's interesting. There's a place where the big monument is, which is not the actual site. The actual site is a ravine, which most people don't know about. But even on the site, the communists, when they finally, after much protest, put a monument there, it doesn't say anything about Jews. It says here the German fascists killed like 35,000 people. But all of Eastern Europe has become a giant Jewish graveyard. Eventually, in 1942, in the very beginning of 1942, when the Germans have the vast majority, they have something close to 9 million Jews more or less under their control. Most of the Jewish population of Europe is in German hands. Or within German territory, albeit some of them are in ghettos and some of them are not necessarily being marched off to concentration camps yet. The Germans realize that machine gunning Jews is not efficient, so they embark on a policy called the Final Solution, which is agreed on at the Wannsee Conference outside Berlin in 1942. And it's put into place primarily by Adolf Eichmann, okay, who's executed, brought back to Israel and executed, the only person executed in the history of Israel, by the way, a brilliant move on Israeli security. And also with Reinhard Heydrich, who's the head of the Gestapo. I want to read you Reinhard Heydrich, head of the Gestapo, 1940 to 1942. Speech prepared for him by Adolf Eichmann at the Wannsee Conference, 20th of January, 1942. Instead of immigration, there is now a further possible solution to which the Führer has already signified his consent, namely deportation to the East. Although this should be regarded merely as an interim measure, it will provide us with a practical experience which will be especially valuable in connection with the future Final Solution. In the course of the practical implementation of the Final Solution, Europe will be combed from west to east. So out of this came the systematic murder of millions of Jews. 6 million is the number given. By the way, many historians say it's 7 million now. 6 specific death camps are set up. There's a lot of concentration camps, but the 6 death camps, we know Auschwitz, of course. Auschwitz, Chelmno, Treblinka, Sobibor, Majdanek, and Belzec are the 6 big camps where the vast majority, especially Auschwitz-Birkenau. This is a place where when it was going at the height of Auschwitz, when it was going at its height, could process, as the Germans would call it, 12,000 Jews a day. Okay, we're talking about an incredible number of people gassed to death, as we know about, and then cremated. I just want to, I kind of want to go into more, too much more on the Holocaust, but I want to talk about the lessons behind it, because and a lot of things are said about anti-Semitism. And the Holocaust, although it overwhelms us with the sheer size of it, 6 million people killed, it's a singular event in human history, the deliberate, systematic execution. I'm not talking about just going to a town and killing people like in the Crusades. The systematic destruction of an entire people for no other reason than there are members of a certain people. Even those who weren't recognized halachically as Jews were killed. Is very unprecedented in human history. But it is merely one of, albeit much more overwhelming, a long history of attacks against the Jews. And the reason for the tradition, our understanding of the Holocaust is the same as our understanding for all anti-Semitism. A lot of people try and give meaning to anti-Semitism. What are we doing? And if you've seen the Why the Jews seminar, all kinds of reasons have been thrown out by historians for why Jews are hated. Because we're different, we're made scapegoats, we killed Jesus, you know, we control the world's economy. All of these things are clearly excuses. Okay, most of them were never even done by the Jews. And certainly any of them which the Jews may have been minorly involved with do not explain the level of animosity and hatred towards Jews. We have to ask ourselves, what is the thing in human history that we've done that has caused the world to hate us so much they feel they have to destroy us? And we get to a guy like Hitler. He's remarkably clear in his ideology. It's the biggest disservice we could do to the Holocaust and those people who died in it would be to say that Hitler's a madman and those Jews died for no reason, which means that there's no meaning behind it. Now, we as Jews, and certainly what I teach in this class, is that everything that happens has a reason and there's meaning to it all. Okay, and if you look at what Hitler says and what he writes, it is very clear that a guy like Adolf Hitler, although he's definitely had his neuroses and he was certainly evil, is very clear and in a certain perspective very correct in his appraisal of what the Jew is in history. And just to read you a couple of little quotes here from what Hitler says. First of all, Hitler's view was that the world used to be, before monotheism and Judaism and the ethical vision of the Jews came along, the world operated like the jungle. The strong survive, the weaker lunch. And that's healthy and natural, because sick zebras don't last long and don't reproduce because they're eaten by lions. And if you take the lion and you give him a steak and you put him in a safari park, he loses his natural ability to function in the world. Then you take him out of that safari park and put him back in the jungle, what happens to him? He gets eaten by another lion because he's now been made wimpy. Hitler's basically saying that this is what the Jew has done to humanity. Another huge mistake we can make by looking at the Holocaust is to view Hitler's destruction of the Jewish community of Europe as a means to an end. While I'm already conquering the world, let's kill some Jews as a sideshow. It's a big mistake. Lucy Davidovits, one of the great Jewish historians of the 20th century, wrote a book called Hitler's War Against the Jew, in which he said something which to me is very obvious but was very controversial at the time. Hitler's destruction of the Jewish community of Europe was not a means to an end. It was an ends in and of itself. Arguably, it was the ends. And clearly from the way the Germans behave from beginning to end, Hitler is consistent in that the major goal of his policy is to eliminate the Jew from the planet Earth. The last thing he says before committing suicide in his bunker in April 1945 is to continue the fight against the enemy of all humanity, the Jew. As if that's the people who are in Berlin destroying Germany. It's the Russians and the Americans. He doesn't say anything about them. It's get the Jew. Okay, so he said Hitler is very consistent in his reasons for hating the Jew and his policy for hating the Jew. And therefore, the destruction of the Jews of Europe is arguably the means, the ends for Adolf Hitler. You can see it also by the fact that he diverts troop transport from sending soldiers to the Eastern Front, which is where the Russians really took the brunt of Germany's offensive. They ate up the Germans, and they spit them out. Okay, Russia, if Germany lost the war, it's because of Russia. Okay, they are the ones who really went full scale into that war from beginning to end. And Hitler has a choice of sending troop transport to send soldiers to the Eastern Front to try and stop the Russian advance, or send Jews to Auschwitz. What does he choose to do? He chooses to send Jews to Auschwitz, meaning from the Nazi perspective, the greater enemy is whom?
The Jew,
not the Russian. The ultimate enemy. Now, I want to take any questions because I want to, if you don't mind, let me just finish. But I want to just read you a couple of quotes of what Hitler says. He says, this is Hermann Rauschning, who wrote many things about collection of what Hitler said. He said, "The Ten Commandments have lost their validity. Conscience is a Jewish invention. It is a blemish like circumcision." He's saying the Jewish people invented the idea of conscience. They leveled the playing field. They took people from being animals, the natural order, and they made what's called the human concept. Oh, we have to be nice to each other and respect and help the weak and the poor. In the jungle, the lion doesn't say to the zebra, "You had a rough day, you rest by the waterhole. I'll go chase some gazelles." Okay, that's what the Jew did to humanity. And he goes on to explain why the Jew has to be killed. He says, if only one country, for whatever reason, tolerates a Jewish family in it, that family will become the germ center for fresh sedition. If one little Jewish boy survives without any Jewish education, with no synagogue and no Hebrew school, it's in his soul. He says, even if there had never been a synagogue or a Jewish school or an Old Testament, the Jewish spirit would still exist and exert its influence. It has been there from the beginning, and there is no Jew, not a single one, who does not personify it. He says that this human concept which has crippled the world is a product of the Jewish people. It's a product of Jews, regardless of Jewish education. Every Jew has it. He calls it a germ center. To eliminate communism, he killed the Bolshevik leaders. To eliminate Christianity, and Hitler was very anti-Christian, he killed the priests. But to get rid of that ideology, which we Nazis view as the most threatening to humanity, we got to kill every single Jew. And Hitler says very clearly in the Holocaust that my thing, National Socialism, is not just a political movement. It is a movement to rebuild humanity, to save the world from this crushing moral and ethical blow. This is an incredible thing. Hitler's not evil because of his understanding of what the Jew is. And he's right on, by the way. This is the traditional Jewish understanding. We are the ethical lighthouse for the world. We're the people who teach the world values. That's from Abraham onward. Hitler's not evil because of that understanding. Hitler is evil because of his reaction to that understanding. He says, I know what the Jew is, and it's evil, and I want to destroy it. I'm going to save humanity. And when you look at it from that perspective, you get a completely different view of what anti-Semitism is about in general and what the Holocaust is about. From the traditional Jewish perspective, we say, this is a struggle between good and evil. It always is. And the solution to anti-Semitism is not by teaching tolerance, which is nothing against teaching tolerance, but it's by getting Jewish values, by getting the world to buy into all the values we're supposed to be teaching the world, because only when the world becomes essentially good will those people who hate us stop hating us. So it's a very, very powerful lesson. I know I've run through what is a very heavy idea in a very short period of time, but to do it any other way basically makes the Holocaust seem as a meaningless, a horrible yet more or less meaningless event. Okay, and it is not. And to make it the number one point of Jewish identity, which it is for Jews in America, and yet to miss the message is really the ultimate tragedy. So we have 6 million Jews dying, and with the end of the Holocaust, we really have the end of European Jewry, because those Jews who haven't assimilated themselves out of existence, the brunt of the Holocaust is felt in Eastern Europe, in the heart of what was the Jewish world, the religious Jewish world, in Poland and in Ukraine and Lithuania. There's nothing really left. Those Jews who survive in Eastern Europe and Russia are going to be forcibly assimilated. And that small Jewish community in Western Europe is more or less also going to disappear out of existence. There's an excellent movie, by the way, called The Long Road Home, I think it's the title, which won an Academy Award 2 years ago, showing the Jews trying to make from the what happens. And by the way, a lot of those Jews who survived in Europe through the Holocaust and come back to Poland, Jews are murdered in Poland after the Holocaust. Many communities in Eastern Europe, like in Lithuania, in Kovno, etc., in Vilnius, the Gentiles murder the Jewish population before the Germans even get a chance to do it. They're happy to do it. So this really brings us to the end of the community of Europe and the last chapter of our story, which is the rebirth of the Jewish state, which is going to be one of the two great refuges for the Jews in the modern period. Okay, let's stop there.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a free cassette catalog, in the U.S. call toll-free 1-800-VOICES-3. Our email address is voices@aish.edu, or write to us at P.O. Box 14149, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.